Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Mr. Sickleman is the police commissioner. I'm not going to subject him to public scrutiny without conclusive evidence.
Okay, let's do this.
I'll be the call.
Mom, everything you need is right here.
I'll be the heart.
I'll be with you the whole time.
I know what you've done, and we documented all of it.
You think they're going to believe?
It can't be left undone. No matter what, don't
panic. I'm not panicking!
We have to make it better.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is my co-host, Chad Riley.
Am I here?
I would hope you're here. Either you're here physically or you're in spirit, but...
It's the spirit of Chad.
Yeah, right. Well, we gotta...
No, unfortunately, I'm stuck right here.
He is. But it's
no,
a good,
I think it's a good thing.
It's a good kind of stuck.
It's not unfortunate. It's very fortunate. I'm happy to be here with you, Eddie.
We got a great show in store for you today. The Filmlosophers is presented by Mingle Media TV and recorded live each week by a pair of precocious super geniuses at VGB Studios.
Who would that be?
I don't know. Corey isn't here, so...
I know.
Developing an intricate plan to save someone's life with the power of your mind and the purity of your convictions... Okay, we can't really help you with that, but we can help you stay up to date on the latest movie news and reviews of film releases with new episodes of The Filmlosophers every Wednesday morning on Google Play, iTunes, Player FM, Audio Boom, Libsyn, and Stitcher. Don't let the weight of the world rest on your shoulders alone. Connect with us on social media to release some of the tension. Like the show on Facebook at facebook.com/filmlosophers and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/filmlosophy101for more opportunities to connect. Last but not least, you can access all of our previous episodes at vgbstudios.com alongside other amazing podcasts like Video Game Bang and Me, Myself, and I. We got a great movie to review for you today, and we're actually both kind of excited because we weren't really sure what to expect from the film.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure nobody is sure what to expect from this film.
Yeah.
There have been a lot of comments made online about, like, what is this movie supposed to be based on the trailers?
Yeah. And even when we went into the theaters, even when we were leaving, there was still a lot of mixed receptions from a lot of the people who were leaving, but this really was one of those types of films that kind of caught you by surprise.
Yeah, it kind of defies classification in some ways.
Exactly. That movie that we're talking about is called The Book of Henry, which debuts this Friday in theaters. Single mother Susan Carpenter works as a waitress alongside her feisty family friend, Sheila. Taking care of everyone and everything in his own way is Susan's older son, Henry. Protective of his brother and a tireless supporter of his often self-doubting mother, Henry blazes through the days like a comet. When Susan discovers that the family next door harbors a dark secret, she's surprised to learn that Henry has devised a plan to help the young daughter. So, we're just going to say this right at the get-go. This is going to be a spoiler review. You cannot really get into reviewing the film all that much without understanding a lot of the key parts.
Yeah, to try to
film.
Talk around some of the stuff would really undermine the whole review process.
Yeah, and it would do no service. It would do a disservice to you as the listener because, I mean, obviously you want to know as much as you can in terms of the whether or not you should go see the film. And honestly, it's not like you can't surmise your own, your own thoughts on what actually ends up happening in the film.
This music is very, like, nerve-wracking. I'm like anxious.
Yeah, I'm like twiddling
you're just
my
like,
fingers.
You're basically setting up the review, and I'm like, my heart rate is starting to go up.
Well, let's go ahead and jump right into this. Directed by Colin Trevorrow, the film stars Naomi Watts, Jaden Lebeher, Jacob Tremblay, Dean Norris, Sarah Silverman and Maddie Ziegler. For a little bit of backstory, Jaden Lieberher, he's actually the young boy who will be playing one of the key roles. I think he'll be playing George in the upcoming It film that will come out later this year. And then to add a little bit more backstory, Jacob Tremblay was the young child actor from Room with Brie Larson. And Sarah Silverman's just whatever.
And I believe I heard somebody saying, although I didn't track this down, but I believe I heard somebody in after the film screening saying that Maddie Ziegler was on
Dance Moms.
Dance Moms. Yes. Yeah, I was like some show on cable that I have no interest in ever watching, but she came from that.
Yeah, she was one of the little girls in the entire series. So, yeah. And then, of course, Dean Norris is the infamous brother-in-law to Heisenberg in the hit AMC show Breaking Bad.
He does, like, bad guys so well.
He really does. He just has this kind of rough outer exterior.
He's got a great scowl.
Oh, yeah.
Like, when he lowers his thing and his eyes are kind of looking barely even... It's just... It's glowering and it's good. It's good, bad.
They're called minerals! Just Breaking Bad joke. Anyway... The film was written by Greg Hurwitz, writer of ABC's 2011 series, V. Trevorrow and Hurwitz found each other to be congenial, but then Trevorrow was hired to direct last year's film. I believe it was last year's, right? Or the year before.
Jurassic World?
Yeah.
Mm.
I want to say it was last year.
I don't remember the year it came out. Anyway, he directed Jurassic World, and so this film got put on pause.
2015. Yes. This film got put on pause, and they were actually considering another director, but it never came to fruition. So by early 2015, after Trevorrow finished Jurassic World, he then returned to finish.
And I'm so glad he did, because one of the things that really comes across, it was fairly apparent with Jurassic World, but it really comes across here. I think that you really need... Not only do you need the right performer in place, but I think you really need the right guy at the helm to do a child-centric story arc or complete story really, really well. I think in this film, you've got a lot of focus on the two boys, the two sons of Naomi Watts' character, and a lot of the scenes are one or both of them with no adults in the frame, and I think that he does a great job of kind of capturing... Even the height, like the perspective of the younger person and what they see in a situation that's different from what an adult would see.
Yeah.
I think you had shades of it for sure in Jurassic World with the younger cast members there. But here with the Book of Henry, it's very much one of the main narrative forces of the story is what the children are seeing and going through and how they're interpreting their world.
Oh yeah, most definitely. And I think that's, like you said, I agree completely. That's one of the more prevalent high points throughout the film that continues throughout in terms of being able to have the children convey exactly what it is that's going on and having them be able to allow that not only to be translated in a childlike way, but even for a way for the adults to connect. In the moments, there are several moments throughout the film where something is going on, and even though it's maybe a child who's dealing with it, the conveying of the emotions is done in a very thoughtful and thought-provoking way that allows for the adults to really capture what's going on in the scene.
Yeah, it's interesting. This film definitely has, and we'll get into it, but this film definitely has some really unique... motifs, if you will. I mean, Henry's mindset to begin with. I mean, he's essentially a grown-up already. He's that smart, and he knows stuff about every facet of life, every kind of profession, all kinds of things that the adults don't know, like they've never studied. And he has studied and retained all of this information and knows how to leverage it. But then, even in spite of all of that, it feels so authentic to, I guess, the process of growing up in a way. And I'm really excited because in some of the press junkets and everything for this film, they've been asking Trevorrow, the director, you know, what his plans are for Star Wars Episode 9, because he's on deck for not the one that comes out this winter, but the one 2 years
not
following
episode 8,
it.
But Episode 9.
And so they've asked him, you know, Episode 9, what are your plans like that? And, you know, what are you looking at? And one of the things that he's been saying is needing to make sure that it's accessible for children, but not dumbed down.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that's the thing that really sets apart, you know, like I was mentioning Jurassic World and this movie. It's not dumbed down because certain scenes are from the children's perspective.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's quite mature and well-developed in those moments. And I love that he has, you know, the team in place and the personal wherewithal to make it feel that way.
So let's go ahead and jump right in terms of the beginning of this review and go ahead and start it out. So first impressions before going into the film. Like I said, like we're stating here, we didn't really know exactly what we were getting into. This wasn't exactly... If you've looked at the run of films that we've had in the last 2 years and the ones that really are getting the attention, they're usually either franchise films or films that are through larger studios that kind of have a certain formula that they take. So you can
sure.
you can typically, you know, predict how a certain film's going to come about. And this one, you know, just in the trailer alone, the trailer throws you for like a huge loop because you think, oh, this is some kind of family film, this is some kind of interesting little, you know, family drama type thing. And then it takes a turn, you know, extremely left and starts talking about planning and plotting for murder.
Right.
So, honestly, going in, I really didn't know what to expect. My only impression was that, one, Colin Trevorrow was directing, and two, there was a lot of well-developed actors and actresses in this film. Not so much
ensemble, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, that I could have a little bit of ease in knowing, okay, Naomi Watts is playing the mom. You have Dean Norris, who's done great as being, you know, just this negative person and just really downright, like you said, a
villain. I'm sure he's done lovely roles, too, here and there.
I'm sure.
That's not what he was hired for in this film.
No. Jacob Tremblay, great child actor. He's remarkable. He was remarkable in The Room, and so seeing him in this, it's good to see him.
In Room, not The Room. The Room is a very different movie.
I did not hit her. No. And then Jaden Leberher, he's another great child actor.
He was so good.
Yeah.
In this movie, he was so good.
So it's like you knew the hands that were going to catch you when this film began. You just didn't know how the story was going to transgress. And that was where I was at coming in. I knew, okay, the director, the actors, actresses I trusted, I just don't know where this film is going to take me.
Yeah, there's a big question mark. I mean, before, even for some people after seeing the movie, there's a bit of a question mark, not because the movie is obtuse and hard to understand, but it's definitely not, it's not your typical, like, growing up, you know, like a rite of passage or difficult childhood drama. Like, it's none of those things and partially all of those things. And it's really quite an interesting little creature of a film, which is nice because I was talking to somebody before we went to the screening and trying to describe what I understood the film to be, which I didn't really know. And I said, well, as far as I've seen in the trailers, the main character is kind of like a modern day Da Vinci who is really, really smart beyond his years, has knowledge of a lot of different areas in life, keeps a sketchbook of some sort that he draws diagrams in, and then he has a really strong conscience that something goes wrong with somebody in their neighborhood and he wants to make it right. And the way that he wants to make it right may be mistaken because it seems like he's trying to get his mom to commit murder. And so that's what you kind of gather in snatches from the trailers that have been released. prior to this screening. And ultimately, I think the film initially opens in limited release, so check your listings to see where you could see the film. It might not be available everywhere. But after having seen the film, remarkably, as confusing as the trailers made it, there was a lot in the movie that did to some extent surprise, but on the whole, the movie did not shock me, because the trailers actually do a decent job setting you up for what you're going to see.
Very true. So coming into the film, you get introduced to the characters actually rather quickly. You're introduced to who the people, pretty much who you plan to see for the whole film. Usually it's through the course of time that you begin to get introduced to most of the characters, but it seems like a lot of them are just right there at the beginning. You meet Henry, who, like we said, is played by Jaden Lebeher. And I know I'm probably saying that wrong, and I'm probably going to get all these emails or whatnot.
That's okay. I won't correct you, because I'll probably also say it somewhat wrong.
But you're introduced to him, and the scene that you're introduced to him is in that scene that you see in the trailer. They actually released the whole clip where he's talking about his legacy. It's where you can...
Oh, in school. Was the first scene of the film?
Yeah, that's one of the first scenes where they're just all sitting around and whatnot. Hmm. And then his brother, who's named Peter, played by Jacob, and then the mom, and then you meet the friend next door, which I forget her name, Christina. Yes, next door. And then you meet through the noise and whatnot, Glenn Sickleman, Mr. Sickleman. But one of the unique things right away that you are right away given is, like Chad said, this is definitely a child prodigy. This is somebody who has a very high intellect, somebody who ultimately runs the entire family in terms of finances and making the right decisions. Because as you see the maturity of somebody like Henry, on the flip side, the mom is a video game addict.
Yeah, she's like a total maniac, on the console.
Like, he's asking about financial papers, and she's like, oh, it's over there, I forgot to give it to you. And he's like, you can't play better when you do that. She's like, of course I can, look at this. And it's a very interesting dynamic. And then with Peter included, Peter's kind of the middle ground between the two of them. He's kind of the one that grounds both of them in my mind. He's not so immature, but then he's not so mature like Peter.
And he has the whole, like, playing second fiddle kind of mentality, and he gets picked on at school and whatnot. But, it's interesting because, it is definitely, like you mentioned, it's one of those movies that sets up an atypical family dynamic, right? So you've got a single mom and her two boys, upstate New York. I believe it was filmed in the Westchester area. I don't know if that's where it's meant to be literally set, but I mean the cars have New York license plates.
Yeah.
So it's the more idyllic, picturesque New York, not the city, not Manhattan,
no,
or anything directly right there with it. But lots of foliage, lots of natural settings, stone bridges and things like that. It's a very nice looking area. And in this area, then you've got this mom and her two sons. And the older of her two sons is so smart that he is running the family. Like, he's guiding his younger brother and protecting him from, the bully at school and whatnot. And at the same time, when he gets home, he's handling all the family finances. He's repeatedly telling his mother that she should quit her job because he's already making them super rich. Like, they're already rich because of the investments that he's made and the various different bank accounts that he's using to funnel money from one place to another. I mean, she doesn't even know all the things that he's been doing. Nor is it ever explained explicitly to us,
no,
as the audience. We do come to find out later in the film what that sum of money looks like. But you don't know for sure. He's just very confident that she should quit her job, because she doesn't have to. She can focus on her real passion, which is writing and illustrating children's books, which she tests on her boys as bedtime stories to see, you know, if they like them and if they think that they're going to work. And as you mentioned, in the meantime, when she's not working, she's playing video games and basically just letting him handle it. And she really truly defers to his judgment.
Yeah.
She acknowledges that in many ways, he's a better adult than she is.
Oh, several times throughout the entire film. It's funny, some of the scenes that you see in the trailer that are, you know, some of those scenes that we're talking about, like the scene where she's talking to her boss and he's like, well, you know, I can set you up on direct deposit. And she's like, I don't know, I have to ask Henry. And he's like, you got to ask your 11-year-old son. And other times where she's talking with her friend who's played by Sarah Silverman.
Loved her in this movie. She was so good in this movie.
Here's the thing. I don't normally like Sarah Silverman. I'm not a big fan of her humor. I wasn't a really big fan of the show that she used to have.
Sure.
But I think Sarah Silverman has come at a point in her life, in her career, where making roles like this is exactly what she was meant to do. Like, this type of role for her suit her so well.
So good. Like, just like you mentioned, just perfect. Like a glove.
Like it was a just glove. Like,
That's exactly what this character needs to be like.
And Sheila, Sarah Silverman's character, has this, she's the best friend of the mom, but
yeah,
she
they
also,
work together at like the retro style, like candy shop, soda fountain, diner place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Little dive, actually, which is owned by, and they never really say the name of the guy, but owned by the guy
Bobby Moynihan from SNL.
By Bobby Moynihan. Yeah. But she has this interesting relationship with Henry as well, where she likes Peter. Peter's, you know, she's whatever. But with Henry, they have this kind of love-hate relationship where they love to hate on each other every time they see each other.
Every time.
And it makes for really fun scenes because you see the two and she stoops to his level, but then his level is a little bit above hers. And so it makes for very fun content and very fun scenes. So yeah, I think this scene was really built around her as an actress, and I think she thrived in that particular role.
Yeah, I mean it was a terrific. You don't get too much of her, you don't get too little of her. Like, she does exactly what she needs to do within the context of the story, and it is meaningful.
Oh yeah, yeah, no doubt. I need to ask, so Chad, you're obviously a very well-known screenwriter in this room.
I don't know that I'm very well-known.
Out of the two of us here, you are the more well-known.
I will accept.
So, here's the thing. Child prodigies have been used throughout TV and film for ages, even literature. The idea of having somebody who has a higher intelligence than the rest of them and that person ending up being a child. Whether if it's something like Encyclopedia Brown or whatever it may be. In this case, in this scenario, do you think this helped create a stronger film? Or do you think it was somewhere along the lines of possibly lazy writing, almost like creating the convenience for the sake of convenience?
You mean using a main character who is a child prodigy?
Yeah, in the scope of this film.
I don't think that I would call it lazy writing because, quite frankly, you have to do a lot more research to make it plausible. I just, from behind the scene, my behind the scenes brain says, in order for Henry to speak with authority on a variety of mature adult subjects, you as the writer need to really dig into all those things and make sure that your precocious child prodigy is not going to say something completely wrong. Now, is there some level of contrivance and just a fabrication? Sure, absolutely, because it's a fictional story. You can make it do whatever you need it to do or want it to do. So, for example, what I mean when I say that is you are meant to take it on faith that he is as smart as it seems that he is. You never see him doing his research. Well, you rarely see him doing his research to gain the level of knowledge that he has. He just has it. He's regularly putting adults in their place and like telling them they're stupid, basically. But not a lot of times when you see a character like this, their motives are still childish because they're extremely smart, but they're still children. What this film does is they position this child prodigy as not so much simply smarter than the adults. He's actually more grown up than the adults. He has a better, more well-rounded and more purposeful perspective that he doesn't back down from. There are numerous areas, and one of the things that you started to touch on that we haven't gone into detail about is the girl next door and her stepfather, who is the police commissioner. We never learn what happened to the mother. She's not in the picture, and we learn later that she's not alive, but we don't know how she died or, you know, the circumstances at all. All we know is this young girl who's in Henry's class, her name is Christina, she lives with her stepfather only, and she seems to be very withdrawn, and that trend becomes more pronounced as time goes on, and Henry is doing his own investigation into the why. Like, why is that happening with her? And as he's doing this, he regularly is confronting his mother, the school principal, Child Protective Services over the phone. Like, he's confronting adults and pointing out things that they should be doing better. Like, a child shouldn't have to point that out to you.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, he does it in a way that oftentimes is belittling, and because he's confused about, yeah, like, why. There's a whole episode not quite midway through the film where they're in a grocery store and he witnesses an altercation between a young man and a young woman, and he wants to do something about it, and his mother stops him and tries to tell him it wouldn't make a difference and probably it would make things worse. And he has a really hard time accepting that logic. And in fact, he kind of never really accepts it. He just abides by his mother's decision.
And here's my thinking. Now the reason why I ask is, and this is not any jab to any writer. If this is the style of writing you do personally, if you're listening to this, you know, kudos to you. If this is the direction you choose to go, utilizing child prodigies in every single one of your stories and whatnot. For me, it's I see it on both ends. I see it as it can be smart writing, yes, because you have to create more of the backing for this character to actually have all this information. How does he have all this information? Does he have a regular routine in terms of his absorbing, you know, information or whatnot? What I'm wondering is that the ability to have convenience of without having to explain in detail that the scene is asking about this. This child knows this. This child gives scene this and scene. This child is being explained this. He's being told this. Child knows this, explains it better to the next person that is telling him in a much better fashion and scene. In my mind, I would see it. I could see both sides in terms of, you know what, it could be if it's done a little bit more just horribly. But in my mind, can that be equated to, and I think lazy writing is the wrong term to use.
It's totally the wrong term to
use.
They're using
wrong direction.
His intelligence as a crutch to not tell
there we go.
More of a story.
See, this is why we have you on the show, Chad.
Here's the thing that you would never know,
mm-hmm,
going into the movie. You might catch on to it by the end. This movie is about the mother. The mother is the main character of this movie. Henry is not. He looks like the main character, and he's completely tied into the fabric. But in terms of the overall transformational story arc that we all look for in all good stories, this is a movie about Naomi Watts' character,
mm,
and the process that she goes through quite painfully to stop relying on her oldest son and really own her role as a mother. Not that she wasn't a good mother. She was a good mother the whole time. She was very loving with her children. She picked them up from school. She read bedtime stories to them. She you know, doted on them, it was very obvious. I'm not saying that she was a bad mother. Being a single mother is very, very difficult. And being a single parent, period. But really, in terms of the transformational arc of the story, that belongs to her character.
Mm-hmm.
So it's called The Book of Henry. He is the narrator. He's the voiceover narrator of many scenes from start to finish. He is the catalyst for basically everything that happens. But the story is about the mother's character. And I think that's where you go from, oh, is this lazy writing to like actually smart writing? It's incredibly intelligent writing. Mm-hmm. Because I think I am not a parent, but having observed a lot of parents, I think that thread of knowing that your children are most likely going to be smarter, more talented, more accomplished, more, you know, full of wisdom than you ever were, that's something when you're a parent and you're coming to grips with that, you know, it can be difficult, you know, not in the sense that you're always jealous, but just accepting this human being who happens to be my child is better than me in some way or in every way or, you know, whatever. And her reaction to that reality, because it's extremely obvious, because his intelligence is so head and shoulders above, you know, whatever. I mean, you mentioned the scene where he's giving a speech to his, what, fourth grade class or whatever, mm-hmm. about it's legacy. My legacy. And the kid before him is like, I want to play dodgeball in the Olympics. And then everybody claps for him. And that's total, like, normal 11-year-old boy perspective. And then here comes Henry, and he says, well, he's talking about an existential crisis and how do you, you know, look toward other people and do for them and whatever. And the teacher then of the class, of course, the students don't know what to make of everything he just said.
Mm-hmm.
And the bell rings, of course, and the kids are all leaving. And then the teacher says, remind me again why we can't put you in a school for gifted, specifically for gifted advanced students. And his response is this very, like, almost by rote, by memory recitation of something he's been told by his mother or a psychologist or whatever. And he says, because it would hinder my psychosocial development to be, you know, put in an advanced group when, you know, I need to socialize with my peers, essentially, is what he's saying. You know, and so, I mean, that kind of tells you everything you need to know about him. He knows that he's advanced, but he has accepted that he needs to stay where he is so that he doesn't, you know, he's not overly awkward or whatever.
Yeah.
But, you know, anyway, I think that to get back to your question, I don't think it's lazy writing. I think that it's an extremely unique way of discussing that that often difficult dynamic between parent and child and who needs to be the parent, because ultimately the climactic scene of the film, which we'll talk about in a little while, involves a realization that the mother comes to in the midst of almost like to the letter, to the punctuation mark, following her son's, not even advice, but his instructions. She is letting him tell her what to do, and then she makes a choice as a parent. She makes a choice and basically, in a way, says to him, no, you are not the parent. You are the child. It is my job to be the parent. And that's a big moment for her.
Yeah.
That resets the whole flow of the rest of the story.
True.
Susan. Well, sorry. I kept forgetting the mother's name. I'm like, the mother. Her name is Susan in the story.
Susan, yes. So going forward in talking about the storytelling process, so the film is essentially a three-act structure. It's you mm-hmm. have your beginning, your middle and end, your introduction, your inciting incident, and your resolution for this film. And like we said, spoilers all around. Aside from what Chad said, there's still other stuff that we're going to mention that are spoilers.
Yeah, here's where it gets really deep, because this film gets really deep. So, like, really deep.
So once Henry discovers that there is bad things happening next door with the stepfather and Christina, He begins to write out what needs to get done in order for, he begins to start creating a plan on how to get rid of Mr. Sickleman, Glenn, the stepfather. And in the midst of this, you see him sporadically have these headaches. And you think nothing of it because he'll take an aspirin there, he'll take something here or there, and he'll be fine. So what ends up happening is he has a seizure in the middle of the night, causes everyone to go in a panic. The mom takes him to the hospital. They come to find out he has an inoperable tumor in his brain.
Yeah, a large mass.
And because of this, he does end up passing. Now, before he passes...
Wow, you just rushed through all that.
Yeah, well...
Okay. Yeah. It is extremely well done.
It is.
I remember, and I can't remember right now if you've seen this or not, but I remember watching the movie The Impossible on an airplane surrounded by strangers and like almost bursting into uncontrollable tears because of not only the story and the fact that that was the movie. I don't remember what year it was released, but Naomi Watts was also the mother in that film. Ewan McGregor was the father. Tom Holland, a young boy, he was the older brother of that family. It was set during the tsunami in Indonesia and throughout, you know, Southeast Asia. And they were a family on vacation that were caught up in the tsunami, the giant flood, separated. You know, the mother is with one son, the father is with the other two sons, and they're trying to get to safety and find each other and whatever. And it had so many moments in it that were just these very, very pure moments of parent and child, whether it was the dad and one of the sons or the mother and one of the sons or both or whatever, had all these moments of like parent, child, pure connection. And throughout the hospital sequence of this film, you once again have these incredible and not just parent-child moments, because this was where Sarah Silverman really shined. I don't know what. Anyway, the dynamic between Sheila and Henry took a very meaningful turn.
Yeah,
and was just spot on, so well done, like a really well played duet in the midst of an orchestra piece, and some moments with the mother and each of her sons, or the two sons, talking to each other. And it's got all of this emotionally rich, like gut-wrenching content. I mean, people all over the theater were sniffling.
Yep.
For like 5-10 minutes straight.
Oh yeah.
And then, like you mentioned, Henry ends up passing. And you know that you're like barely halfway through the movie. I mean, you're a little more than halfway through the film. So you're thinking, but that was the title character. What's going to happen? And the thing with the neighbor girl is not at all resolved. So what's going to happen there?
Mm-hmm.
Because you know, as an audience member, you know she's being abused. You don't yet know how exactly, but you know that he's right. And has been the whole time, when he's challenging his mother, when he's challenging the principal, when he's calling CPS, and then he watches the CPS guy come and talked to Child and Protective Services, by the way, sorry. Watching the guy talk to the police commissioner on the front porch, the guy, the stepdad calls his stepdaughter down. She says, no, it's all good, whatever. And then Henry turns the paper over and sees that the CPS guy is the brother of the police commissioner.
Yep. Something.
So he has no intention of opening any kind of investigation. And then he's trying to call the next county over, or the next district, and he's like, can you just have a second opinion? And they say, well, no, we don't cross into other jurisdictions. And he's like, but it's happening, and they're sweeping it under the rug. Isn't there a responsibility to do the right thing? So you have all of this like really intense stuff. You are emotionally invested in the resolution of Henry's goal of saving the girl next door.
Yeah.
And in the midst of all that, you have this huge emotional trauma, and Henry passes. And then it's Susan and
Peter.
I'm like, Thomas. Peter. And so you're sitting there, and you've got to do a bit of a reset as an audience member. You're like, oh, well, but Henry's not there. So are we going to fix this or what?
Yeah. So, and that actually marks kind of the transition between Act 1 to Act 2 in terms of the film, so to speak. Cause,
Act 2 into Act 3, kind of, but yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it marks that transition over, and then you
because then that's where you really do, it's Susan's story really takes over from that point. Henry still is present. He has meticulously noted in his book, which is the title of the film, The Book of Henry. So in his book, he has meticulously noted his plan for how his mother is going to save the girl next door.
Yes.
And he has recorded all of it onto like a Walkman, basically.
As well as get written down all these contingencies as to why this has to happen this way, why this needs to happen, why you can't do that, and why you can't do this. I mean, ultimately, his little brother kind of makes a joke. He's like, you know, because the mom says, well, Henry hasn't thought about everything. And little brother's like, oh, it's Henry. Henry always thinks about everything. Right. So, excuse me. So this film, talking about structure. So, and I'm going to throw it back into your court, Chad. Sorry, you're going to be doing a lot of talking.
I thought we agreed that you would do a lot of talking this time.
No, sir. So, why don't you explain a little bit, what is the difference? So this film, obviously, like we said, is a three-act structure. What is the difference between this and a five-act structure? What exactly makes the two extra acts different than what happens here?
I mean, it's not that, to the casual observer, you wouldn't necessarily notice a huge difference. There are typically if you had a five-act structure, which is actually more common in stage plays and television episodes, because of the way that you pace those works versus a film oftentimes does have a three-act structure. But it's basically how many major turning points do you have, just in a nutshell. That's mm-hmm. not, there's nuance to it for sure. But when you go from one segment to the next, there should be a very definitive turning point. And oftentimes, you need that in television, for example, because of all the commercial breaks.
Yeah.
And so you need to, not just for timing purposes, but to keep the audience interested, you need to have arrived at your first major turning point before the second break. You know, assuming the first break comes during the credits, you know, whatever. Then by the time the second commercial break happens, your audience needs to really like almost be at a cliffhanger moment where they need to stay through the commercials and be with you as soon as the show comes back.
Okay.
And so oftentimes you have more breaks in an hour of television than obviously you do in a movie. So movies typically do, many of them retain a three-act structure. A lot of the more, I guess you could say more of the blockbuster type, big action films sometimes will have a five-act structure because they need to take you through multiple setbacks, switchbacks, and accomplishments. A story like this is much, much quieter and doesn't need all of that activity, which is why a three-act structure here makes a lot of sense. So essentially, first act, you've got the basic setup of the story, essentially leading up to when you watch Henry witness something through his window looking across the yard into his neighbor's house. So he witnesses something that you don't see, and he kind of backs away from the window. And then he now is immovable in his quest to save the girl from the abusive stepfather. So that is Act 1 transitioning into Act 2. And then, as mentioned, the whole sequence leading up to Henry ultimately passing and all the, you know, tears and sniffles and everything that happened there, that then transitions you from Act 2 into Act 3, because now the mother has to take over. Because essentially, in the scene before he passes, there's a brief interaction between the two brothers, and Henry tells Peter that Peter has to make sure when Henry goes, Peter has to make sure that their mother reads Henry's book and that Peter does not read Henry's book. And that is like, this is my dying wish to you, my brother, is to make sure that mom gets my book.
Yeah.
Everything is in it. And then, you know, the next sequence, then he passes and it's tragic and very sad and, you know, but very well executed, like very well structured and well played. And that transitions you then, and now it becomes the mother's responsibility. Slash, to a certain extent, it's Peter's responsibility. Peter, as a character, really, really blossoms in Act 3.
Oh, yeah, yeah. In terms of just the dialogue that he ends up having, not only with his mother, but even with the doctor and with several others, which, by the way, the doctor is played by Lee Pace.
Ronan the Accuser.
So... I actually agree in terms of Peter's, you know, the character and the actor himself really blossom really well in that third act. So, and this is actually something we're going to be talking about in a future episode in terms of the real nitty gritty of the difference between the three act structure and the five act structure and just really diving into that, because as you can tell, Chad has a wealth of knowledge there and we're going to really just crack open his head and get into all that.
That sounds painful.
But I have to say, When you were mentioning it, and I had mentioned it earlier, the sequences where you see either Henry or you see his mother looking through the window, and you see you don't see the actual abuse. You see the daughter sitting or laying on the floor or doing something like that, and then you see the stepfather in one place, and then he's not there.
And then he's missing, yeah. Which actually, now that I think about it, I might actually amend where Act 2 transitions into Act 3.
Hmm.
Act 2 and Act 3, the transition point might actually be when Susan sees something next door. It's easy. It's kind of, again, you think that the movie is about Henry.
Yeah.
And in many ways, it still is, but it's actually a movie about the mother.
Yeah.
In terms of the character progression. But... that being the case, it feels a lot more accurate for me to say the transition from 1 to 2 is Henry, you watching Henry see something, and then from 2 to 3, it's you watching Susan see something.
Yeah.
And you basically know what she's seeing, thankfully, without having to see it yourself.
And I think that's the implied horror of this part of the film, this implied just travesty that... what you're not seeing is so much more graphic and horrifying than what they could put on the screen. And you got to give kudos to the direction there. As the film continues on, I have to admit that the dialogue between Henry after he's passed, because like Chad said, he's left the tape recorder with the headphones and whatnot so she can hear him. And that sequence really plays out very... it's fun at some times, but then you also get those kind of hard, real moments throughout the course of that dialogue, because you can tell that Naomi Watts' character is really wanting this to be an actual conversation she's having with her son. And then there are moments where she's reminded that it's just a recording. And in inserting those parts into that, because you could have kept it on a little bit more of a higher note in terms of that concept, that dialogue between the two.
Sure, because I mean, Henry literally like knows what his mother's going to say to him. So in his pre-recorded instructions, he pauses and then responds to what he knows she's going to say.
Yeah.
So it feels like dialogue. It feels like a conversation that he's right there talking to her.
Yeah.
He just knew a lot in advance, but I agree with you. There are certain moments when she either pauses too long or doesn't do the reaction he was expecting, but then the tape still plays what he thought he was responding to. And she has a moment of like, oh, right, because my son isn't actually here with me.
Yeah.
This is a tape recording.
And it's done, these scenes are done not to evoke so much more emotion like the previous scenes did, but to remind you that this is the realism that she's going through, that this mother is struggling, which, and this is another thing we didn't really touch on, the process as to how she goes about grieving for her son.
Sure.
And the way she responds to that, and the way she responds to Peter and him, you know, seeing this happen. And it's just even the way she responds to Sheila, what's her name's character. It's just it's done so well, and it's heart wrenching. But at the same time, you know that this is a realistic take. This is something that somebody else could probably relate to, that grievance and trying to understand. You know,
yeah, just that numb to the world.
Exactly.
Like, this, I don't even live in reality right now.
Exactly. Exactly. That's what I was trying to get to.
She goes back to work too early. Somebody says, is this regular or Diet Coke? So she grabs the thing and starts drinking it.
Shugs
and then
it.
Pauses for a second and looks at the person and says, it's diet. You know, and she at one point she's trying to convince Peter, her boy who's still with her, that they're going to eat dessert all week. She mm-hmm. packs dessert only into his lunches, and you know all the it was a very well played, authentic feeling.
Oh, yeah.
Like parent grieving the loss of her child and still needing to be a parent and not knowing what direction is up.
Yeah.
You know, and you're right. She has that exchange essentially while she drinks somebody else's Diet Coke. And then the boss, Bobby Moynihan, comes and says, essentially, you came back too soon. I need you to go home. Also, your son Henry sent a letter before he passed that got to me today informing me of just how much money you have in a bank account that he has managed for you. And you don't need to work at all.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's like upwards of $600,000+ and still going to gain money because of the way he set up the investments.
Yeah.
So, but then that gets into kind of that witty back and forth dream, whatever that she and the best friend get into. Because the whole movie, you've got Sheila, Sarah Silverman's character, talking about she won the lottery and her $84 million quickly became $16 million after taxes and fees and what am I going to do with $16 million and whatever. And at first, you almost believe that it's genuine. Why would she be, you know, a waitress at a 1950s-style candy store or diner thing? But, you know, whatever. But then it's this scene when Susan is told to go home and Sheila follows her out and they kind of continue that dialogue that you really realize that this is them being somewhat playful and talking about their dreams instead of their reality. And that's the whole thing with Susan's character.
Yeah.
The dream versus the reality. In the dream world, my son is smart enough to manage my entire family while I play video games. In the real world, I need to step up because my son doesn't know everything and in fact is no longer around. Now, it turns out she was in the real world the whole time,
mm-hmm.
but she was living a bit of a fantasy life.
Yeah.
And now she has to wake up. And really, it's, she starts to kind of, I don't know if she believes right away that what Henry has written in this book, I mean, she fights it. She tries to go to CPS herself. She does things to try to not follow his instructions. And then she witnesses something happening next door. Thankfully, she immediately intervenes to stop whatever it was, which we have a pretty good indication of what it was that was about to happen. And she rushes downstairs. She grabs her phone. She calls the neighbor, the police commissioner, and, you know, just anything to keep him on the phone and to distract him and to keep him from doing what he was about to do. But then her resolve is set.
Yeah.
And she follows to the letter. She goes and purchases an expensive
mm-hmm.
sniper rifle. She learns how to shoot it. She, all kinds of things. She, all of this is premeditated by her son, leading all the way up to the school talent show.
So in terms of the school talent show, the film ultimately has it set up to where Henry has it timed down to the very second, to where once his mother picks up Christina and her son and drops them off, she has exactly 45 minutes to go lead Glenn out to the middle of the forest where he has his fort, leads him to the exact line of sight as to where she was supposed to place the gun, and she was supposed to fire and shoot him right in a place where his body can get carried away, and or it can fall in a place where it's inconspicuous, and she could take it to a place where I guess it is
dump the, it off a bridge.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, mind you, all this is happening, and she's driving like.
And it sounds a lot more morbid than it plays on screen. I mean, it is a morbid like an 11-year-old planned a way to murder the police commissioner to stop him from abusing his stepdaughter. Like, there is a lot of darkness in the context of the story. Thankfully, the way that it's filmed is not as dark as the subject matter itself.
Yes. And so as this is happening, the mother is following everything to the letter of the law in the book. She leads him out by drawing him out with the walkie-talkies, and she has him in perfect line of sight. And while she's trying to get the sight all lined up perfectly, she accidentally hits the this little structure.
Kind of like a Rube Goldberg contraption that Peter has started to build in honor of his brother.
Yeah. And so this is all happening. She's trying to get the line of sight going on while all these little mechanisms are going off. He hears these noises, Glenn, the guy who she's supposed to be shooting. And in the midst of all this noises, as soon as Henry is beginning to tell her, you should be lining up right now, you should be getting this getting a clear shot, you should be doing this.
Don't let anything distract you. Exactly. Just breathe. You've got this. You've got this. Take the shot. Take the shot. Take the shot, Mom. Take the shot.
And as soon as that happens, the Rube Goldberg device that Peter made ends up finishing, and at the end of it, he has these pictures of him and his brother fall like a cascade down.
Yeah, it's like Polaroid pictures. It's really adorable.
It is. And that is the wake-up moment for Naomi Watts' character, Susan, as right there in that moment, she realizes as she's hearing Henry in her ears saying, take the shot, she realizes, you're just a kid. You're just my son.
Yeah.
And she ultimately rules against killing Glenn. And and the scene, even though we're talking about it, just because for the sake of time, we're just trying to move through this, the scene is done really well. The scene, it takes its time. It paces really well, even though it's a high pace, like a high action type of sequence where everything is moving. The scene does really well to set up that final moment, much like the way that system was.
Structurally, from a story standpoint, you don't know if she's going to do it or not.
No, you don't.
Like, you don't know for sure that she is going to do it, but you certainly don't know that she's not. And then the Polaroids fall, and you see, you know, her beautiful sons and all of the... I mean, because it's like pictures from when they were younger than when they are when you meet them in the film. I mean, it's really like candid family photos. It's a beautiful moment in the midst of a really, really dark moment. Like, she's becoming a sniper.
Yeah, oh yeah, she's becoming an assassin, for hire from her child.
And then here are her boys, and... you know, again, I think that you mentioned earlier about as a character, the character of Peter is a bridge from his brother Henry to his mother Susan. He's somewhere, he has a different personality, perspective, and he has a different role in the story, quite frankly. And it's a perfect way, without him being physically there, it's a perfect way for his influence to be felt. And for her to realize, wait a minute, I have a whole other son. I cannot do this. This is not the way. You are still a child, and you're my child speaking to me through the tape recorder or whatever, but you are still a child. And the way that you have devised as the only solution cannot be the only solution.
Yeah.
You know, because without saying it in so many words, you can see on her face. The thought process is, what happens to my other boy if I get caught for this and put in prison? Like, she doesn't need to say it because it's filmed so well.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And so we're not going to go into the actual details of the ending. That, I mean, we'll leave for you to really enjoy and really understand and, you know, take it for what it is. But ultimately,
things get better from there. Let's just at least say that. Like, yeah. Things do get better from there. The girl from next door, Christina, she has this gorgeous emotional dance sequence that's also happening during the whole, like, take the shot, and the Rube Goldberg thing's going around behind her, and the dance is happening, and, like, your heart rate is going up, and you're getting more anxious, you know, and thankfully, it did not ultimately require the Susan's intervention the way that Henry thought it did.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, ultimately, this was such a beautiful film, a uniquely shot film, uniquely told film. Did you, Chad?
Yes.
Eddie, you have any issues in terms of the film at all?
I did.
Okay, so what did you...
I had one issue.
Oh, boy.
my one issue...
There was no Marvel heroes in the film.
We had a Marvel villain. We had
That's
Ronan
right.
the Accuser. And who knows what these two boys might grow up to do.
That's true.
You never know. My one issue was the doctor. And not the doctor as the doctor, but after Henry passes, the doctor makes a house call and gives his business card to Peter and says, hey, call me if you ever have any more headaches or whatever. And it's a cute moment. And I mean, quite frankly, you never learn exactly where their father is or is not.
No.
But they do kind of set him up as a bit of a father figure for Peter. And then Peter ends up inviting him to the talent show, and the doctor's hoping to see Susan again, and Susan's hopeful too. And, like, it was fine, but it was a little too contrived in the sense of there wasn't a whole lot. He's not in it very much.
Mm-hmm.
And so the scenes where they're saying, yeah, I'd like to see you more too, and I'd like to see you more too kind of stuff, just like in awkward pseudo-public, like stages of grief moment, type things. It wasn't as earned as True. The rest of the character beats in the movie. So if True. I had to pick one thing, it would absolutely be maybe the doctor should have just been the doctor. And, you know, in that one scene, I don't know that he was 100% necessary in the other two scenes that he's a part of.
True.
Structurally speaking, not trying to be a bad human
being. No. I mean, hey, that's why we're here. We talk about these things. I think one of the small minor details that I just had a little bit of an issue was just really piling on a lot of that emotional evocation in that second act, especially with his passing. Mind you, it's a sad sequence, yes, but just one emotional sequence after another, you don't really get a break. And I know it's kind of a, like I said, a sad sequence, but I was struggling to really be able to continue to stay emotionally in that vein where they wanted me to be when I was already in that vein at the beginning, like 10, 15 minutes earlier. But at this point, it was already getting exhausting as a viewer to stay within that, like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. You know, you want to be where the director wants you to be at that emotional moment in a film where you and the director are totally in sync with each other. Mm-hmm. You both have that same exact vibe that you're getting from a scene. And I was having that at the beginning, but when it came towards the end, I was there, but I was already wanting to be out of that. Because I had already been sitting in that vein for so long. It's like it gets exhausting when all you're trying to do is choke back the tears throughout an entire 15 minutes of movie. And I, you know, at the point of that part, I was just like, okay, let's roll it forward. Let's kind of move on. So
it's funny because after the film, we did hear several people commenting on the way out that they didn't like the movie because it was sad.
But then that's just like 15-20 minutes of it.
Well, not really. I mean,
in
the
terms
whole
of the
context of what's happening next door
is sad. Yeah.
Is there almost the entire time, and you want it resolved. I think the thing that's difficult in all of that, because I think it was really well handled from a directing standpoint and even a story pacing. I think the thing that's difficult about it's the placement. Usually you come to these like extreme cathartic grief moments near the end of a film. And here, it again, it's just past the midpoint that the really intense, hard, emotionally traumatizing thing happens. And then, like the characters, you have to figure out what you're going to do for the next hour.
Yeah.
Like, how are you going to feel? And how do you feel when you hear Henry's voice on the tape recorder? Because you just watched him pass.
Yeah.
You know, and that is, I think, personally, yes. Can it be emotionally draining, somewhat exhausting and confusing? Absolutely. And that's exactly the way it is in real life. When stuff like that happens, it's a microcosm of something that like, you've only had an hour and a half to develop some, or an hour and, you know, 10 minutes to develop an attachment with this boy, you know, before that happens. Can you imagine, do you even dare to imagine what it would feel like if that was your real life experience and circumstance? And I think the fact that the film doesn't wait until the climax to put you through the ringer like that was really a brave decision. Because then you do have to keep going with the story, and you have, the story has to mean something beyond that moment. And I think by the end of the film, you definitely do get a sense of, you know, that while it's a terrible thing to have happen with Henry, the story does mean something beyond Henry's view of the world and how to make it right. But they never would have gotten there without him.
True.
And that's where you get, you know, kind of an opportunity for a true catharsis, you know, in the end sequences of the film.
So overall,
also, I thought of another one while I was talking.
Oh boy,
there's another thing I had an issue with that was too convenient and not earned. Was the episode in the gun shop, the first episode with Henry, not the second episode with his mother.
Oh.
It was too convenient.
He ends up walking into a gun shop and kind of overhears a conversation where somebody who has leverage over the gun shop owner, they drop his name in order for them to get a gun without a license. So
like for the exact 3 minutes, the exact 3 minutes that Henry has snuck into this gun shop unseen and overhears something, it is exactly the information he needs his mother to know, you know, weeks later when she's going to illegally purchase a sniper rifle without a license.
So, how many monocles, and does it pass or fail for you?
It does pass. I think that it was a risky venture in many ways, and I really respect the team that made the film to stick with the structure and the feel of the story as it was and not try to make it feel like more of a traditional, you know, difficult family drama or whatever they would have tried. I think the fact that it does mix brightness and darkness throughout the film in terms of subject matter and even scene composition. So it's an interesting approach to kind of reflecting some of what people experience in real life in terms of bright, happy things and sordid, dark things coexisting in very close quarters with one another. And from that perspective, I really respect what they did. I would definitely pass it. I would probably give it a 3.5 out of 5, only because there's a lot to love there. I have a few small quibbles with it, but I think mainly the thing for me was that it was in a way, it was almost too quiet in the way that it was dealing with issues of child abuse. Like, it was a very serious subject and several of the characters took it seriously, but several other characters did not.
Yeah.
When they absolutely should have, and only because it served the story. So I think to have such a hard subject, maybe they should have not treated it so lightly in a way. It's not treated lightly. I don't know how to say what I'm thinking, but it's such a heavy subject. It probably deserved to have a less quiet presentation.
Ah, okay. I see what you mean. For me, it passes. It was a really well done, really good film that honestly, in the mix of a lot of the films we've been seeing lately, this was a fresh, different take on a story that I've never heard before. I don't think really many have in terms of a prodigy child who passes, but before he passes, sets out this huge plan to take out the next door neighbor who is somehow abusing his stepdaughter. That alone is its own category. I don't know where to place it in terms of genre.
Right.
And it's just one of those unique stories that you look and you're like, man, this was interesting. This was a really good experience. In terms of Monocles, I would have to agree with you. I'd give it a 3.5 out of 5. The little bit of over-emotionality in that middle sequence was one of the things. And I do have to agree with the certain response that was seen in terms of this really horrendous act and how certain officials whom I used to work in the educational system and as you do. Yeah. And so knowing this or hearing this, it isn't taken lightly. So seeing an educator being portrayed as somebody who's like, well, you know, he's somebody up there. We're not going to, you know, really kind of take that fight on quite yet. It did kind of rub me the wrong way in terms of like, no, that's not how it works. So those were a little bit of the quarrels I had with it. But overall, it was a good film, a solid film, and I think you guys should go check it out. So if you have a chance this Friday, go ahead to your theater and your local theater and see if it's playing there and check it out.
Take some tissues.
Yes, take as many as you can, or your neighbor's sleeve, whichever works. Before we go, we do want to let you know a little bit of movie news. Unfortunately, it's a little bit more somber news as we find that Adam West passed away earlier over the weekend at the age of 88. West, who was at the pinnacle of pop culture after Batman debuted in January of 1966, only to see his career fall victim to typecasting after the ABC show flamed out, died Friday night in Los Angeles after a short battle with leukemia. He had been struggling for years to find without a steady job, and he ended up finding a new level of fame when he got a job as a voice actor for the hit, long-running Fox animated hit cartoon series, Family Guy. He had stated that when Batman was canceled, the only thing I thought that it would be the end of me, and it was for a bit, West told an audience at Comic-Con in 2014. But then I realized that what we created in the show, we created this zany, lovable world. I look around and I see the adults. I see you grew up with me and you believe in the adventure. I'm so grateful. I'm the luckiest actor in the world, folks, to have you still hanging around. So he will be sorely missed, not just in the industry, but from many fans all over. Adam West is not just a name you throw around. He is the Batman that started all Batmans. So he was one of the big
ones. I mean, he's certainly really, truly the most unforgettable Batman.
Oh, yeah.
I have yet to see. Not that I forget any of the other ones, but you cannot forget.
Without a doubt.
1960s Batman.
No.
You can't. If you can, I applaud you.
Good luck with that. So our hearts and our prayers go out to his family and
absolutely.
Everyone. Just to let you know of a couple upcoming weekend releases before we go. Cars 3 debuts this Friday. The third installment in the Pixar franchise, racing, whatever. Rough Night, All Eyes on Me, the biopic about Tupac. And, of course, this film, The Book of Henry. Yeah. So
there you go.
There you go.
You got four options. Well, depending on where you are, some of them are limited release.
True. I don't know about some places with this film, The Book of Henry. And I'm glad you mentioned that. Really check with your local theaters. Find out if it is playing around you, it is a film worth seeing. So, but that about wraps up another awesome episode of The Film Philosophers. Again, if you like this episode, let us know on our Facebook page or Twitter page at facebook.com/filmphilosophers or twitter.com/filmphilosophy101. If you agree, if you didn't agree, also let us know. We want to hear it. We want to know what it is that you like.
Correction.
What you didn't like.
Eddie wants to hear it. I don't
want
to hear it.
I want to hear it. I want you to talk to me. Let me know. So, but this was a great conversation, and this is one of those films that I think will keep conversations going even after people see it, and that's what film is. That's what film does. Film causes conversations. It creates dialogue even after the credits roll. So, yeah, this was awesome. So, from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Chad.
Class dismissed.